Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio, and we'll return now to the escalating shooting war between Gaza and Israel. Some of the new developments just in the last few minutes. An Israeli spokeswoman says the military there is calling up 16,000 reservists, according to the AP. That could be more evidence that a Gaza ground invasion is coming. And the AP also reporting just within the last half hour or so that air raid sirens have been wailing in Jerusalem now. That's after the rockets fell in the Tel Aviv area. Now air raid sirens wail in Jerusalem, says the AP. Israel, of course, is trying to crack down after what they say is 750 rocket firings from Gaza into Israel this year. So enough from the Israeli point of view. With us is Dan Murphy, who covers the region for the Christian Science Monitor. He has a series of explainers on the situation, including a post called, "Is Hamas Responsible for Rocket Fire? Not Exactly." Hi, Dan. Thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Glad to be on.
And let's start there. What do you mean Hamas is not exactly responsible for the rocket fire?
Well, by the way, that was a couple of days ago now. They're certainly responsible for what we've seen in the past couple of days. The point I was trying to make was simply that there are other militant groups in Gaza. Hamas is the governing authority, but they are not a monolithically powerful governing authority. They will restrain their own rocket fire at times, but groups like Islamic Jihad or the more secular-oriented popular resistance committees will still fire. Israel will get upset and say, hey, you have to crack down on these people or else. And then Hamas is in a position where, it can end up looking like an Israeli policeman, and so it doesn't do as much as Israel would like. The one thing I'll say, at the moment is, again, I think there were 750, give or take, rockets and mortars fired out of Gaza at Israel in the first 10 months of the year. We've had 500 or so in the past 2.5 or 3 days. So, the deterrent point of the air campaign from Israel certainly hasn't worked yet.
Is there any degree to which Hamas wants or has wanted during the year to stop the rocket attacks into Israel, but is powerless to do so?
I wouldn't go so far as saying powerless, but these kinds of things ebb and flow all the time. And by the way, one evidence of their ability to at least slow rocket fire is there have been many occasions in the past where they've come to informal agreements brokered perhaps by the Egyptians with the Israelis, and we see a sharp decline. If you look at these things, month to month, some months this year, there's been 10 or 15, kind of nuisance fire out of Gaza. I think it was back in March there was 150 rockets fired that followed an Israeli basically an attack on a Palestinian militant, killed a couple of people inside the country, and boom, we have an explosion, and then it goes back to sleep again for another month. And this kind of ebb and flow of this long, slow conflict is evidence that there is some control over the pace of rocket fire. But for its own political considerations, Hamas has never been willing to really do what it would take to turn off the tap, because there's a sizable percentage of the population in Gaza who wouldn't look very kindly on that.
And yet you wrote that the Hamas military leader, Ahmed Jabari, who Israel killed with a missile strike in Gaza City this week, was the man most responsible for keeping the rocket attacks under control. So what role did he play in that? And if there were 750 of them this year, even if they hadn't killed anybody until this week, is it fair to conclude that he wasn't very effective at his job, that part of his job?
That's certainly Israel's conclusion. I mean, Ahmed Jabari could either be, a devil or a saint, depending on how you want to look at it. The Israelis said that he was a guy that was involved in the original abduction of Gilad Shalit, who was held for a long time in Gaza. True, he was also the guy who was the main sort of contact on the Palestinian end when they eventually came to a deal to return Shalit home in exchange for Palestinians being released on the other side. He is both was the military leader of the Al-Qassam Brigade, the kind of the armed wing of Hamas or its army. So that means he was both in charge of doing things to attack Israelis, But he was also a guy who had some command and control over those folks and could pull them back. And the point being is when you start, you know, decapitating at that level, how quickly is senior leadership in place that at least can exercise some control over those folks? And do you run the risk of more chaotic militancy out of Gaza that is harder even to deal with?
I guess Israel must consciously be deciding to take that risk, because what you're suggesting is a catch-22. Israel killed Jabari because of missile strikes, but he was the key guy making sure there weren't more of them than there were.
I think catch-22 is great. Just as I was coming on, Sander Al-Imrani, who's a very smart Egyptian-based analyst, I was just looking on Twitter, and he wrote this: the Israel-Palestine situation, return to the status quo is abominable, and change even more so. And I really like that. You know, in the case of this rocket fire, it became politically intolerable for Prime Minister Netanyahu. It is intolerable for the people in southern Israel that live under the very real terror and threat of this kind of constant drip, drip, drip. Will my child be killed, on the bus to school this morning? And so, you know, the Israelis, you know, quite understandably felt they had to do something. However, you know, and as some senior Israeli officials said before this even started, really, you can't stop this by air power, and you need to invade. Well, are they going to invade and reoccupy Gaza? You know, do they want to be responsible for the 1.5 million Palestinians that are crammed in there now? Do they want to remove Hamas entirely and not have any kind of interlocutor, or will that make the situation worse? Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of really tough decisions that certainly face the Israeli side of this right now.
Dan Murphy from the Christian Science Monitor helping us understand the complexities of the Israel-Gaza situation. There is an election in Israel in January, including Netanyahu up for re-election. How much is this bombing campaign part of a political campaign?
Well, everything is political. I mean, I don't think it's a wag the dog, you know, that he's so cynical that he's going to start a war just because it improves his election chances. But he's adding into an election, and particularly, you know, on his hawkish flank, there were lots of people that were calling for this because they really believe that that's in Israel's best interests, and he seems to have agreed with them that he is taking steps that are in Israel's best interests and that are also in his political interests, because, you know, he hopes that the majority of voters are going to see him doing the right thing. In terms of the political calculations in Israel, I'm not so sure. This certainly can't hurt him. It probably helps him, but the key thing to keep our eyes on is the fact that, you know, I think that this was pretty much a popular move within the Israeli electorate, at least, you know, so far.
And what about from the Palestinian side, the risks and benefits of the rocket fire from a Palestinian leadership perspective? Obviously, we're seeing one of the risks come home to roost now, Israeli attacks killing lots of their people to protect against the rocket fire and considering a massive ground invasion. Are there also perceived benefits for these Palestinian groups of the hundreds of rocket firings this year?
Clearly they think so. I mean, there's just this notion of being the resistance. We are not Mahmoud Abbas, you know, the president of the Palestinian Authority from Fatah, who, you know, Fatah and Hamas have been on the outs since 2007. That's why Hamas ends up running Gaza. We're really going to stand up to these Israelis. We're not going to become their policemen or their lapdogs. You know, this is all about messaging. And kind of, you know, this constant occasional rocket fire is about that. Now that it's started, you know, do they want to capitulate and then look weak to some people? Will that provide political openings to more radical actors inside Gaza if they do? And finally, it is the case, and certainly I spent a lot of time in Gaza after Operation Cast Lead in 2008, that a lot of civilians say, hey, our people are dying. You lob a bunch of rockets at Tel Aviv or, you know, at Ashkelon, and everybody gets to beat their chest and feel like a tough guy. And then, you know, a bunch of bombs come over the fence in return and kids die. And the Israelis tighten up the economic blockade and we suffer more. What do we get for that? So that's the other side of the risk to them. But at the moment, both sides seem to be locked into an escalation cycle that I think will run for at least some days yet.
What do you make of the Morsi factor here? The new president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, sent his prime minister, Hesham Kandil, to Gaza on a 3-hour official visit today. He expressed that the Arab world is united behind the Palestinians while Gaza is under assault from Israel. But does Egypt acknowledge that the provocative rocket fire drew the Israeli retaliation?
You know, publicly, certainly not. And by the way, this always is a question of, you know, who it's like a who started it argument. You know, the rocket fires, we responded to the rocket fire. No, we fired the rockets because you assassinated our guy. Well, we assassinated your guy because, you know, you can go back on, you know, to 1948 that way.
Right.
But clearly we have a Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt. We have an Egyptian public that, unlike under the dictatorship of Mubarak, expects their voices and concerns to be taken into account. This is a highly emotive issue. I actually didn't expect Kandil to follow through, the prime minister to follow through on his trip to Gaza today, because I thought, hey, there's a shooting war over there, and that's a really unprecedented step. He did. He toured a hospital with Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas prime minister in Gaza, cradled a wounded or dead baby there, and, you know, it was very emotional. What does Egypt do about it? Probably nothing severe or shocking. But however, you have to look forward and say, you know, how much are they going to cooperate in shutting down the smuggling tunnels from the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt into Gaza that are kind of both an economic lifeline and a weapons lifeline to militants there? Certainly we may see, you know, in the months ahead in terms of resupply, the Egyptians may maybe less vigorous even than they have been in trying to prevent weapons flowing in. The other thing I'll say about Egypt is, to what extent is the military going to let Morsi call the tune on this? They still are very politically powerful actors, hard to read, and they have a very different outlook than certainly the new civilian leadership of that country.
I know you're not in Jerusalem, but what do you make of this one-line dispatch that we have from the AP from 9:49 this morning that just says air raid sirens wail in Jerusalem? It's pretty far from Gaza.
I just did some back of the envelope. Somebody can check, but I think it's about 55 miles or so from kind of what I could figure out with just a ruler on a map from the closest shooting point in Gaza. Air raid sirens in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem are very different things than air raid sirens in southern Israel, less densely populated areas where people have grown used to this. It is a major issue, and that's one reason I think that, you know, this morning the chance of an Israeli incursion has increased. I was kind of shocked that they're actually firing in the direction of Jerusalem, you know, for the simple matter that, you know, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is there, the Dome of the Rock is there, you know, the whole Temple Mount complex, including the sacred stuff to Jews and Christians as well as Muslims. You know, these things usually don't hit anything meaningful, but there was a chance it could land there, and I thought that was a really surprising move, and I'm going to be interested to see how kind of the Arab and Muslim public responds to that, because it's put some stuff that they hold very dear, including big Palestinian population centers, in the line of fire.
Dan Murphy covers the Middle East for the Christian Science Monitor, and his blog on the Christian Science Monitor site is called Back Channels. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, a humanities professor takes on solitary confinement. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio, and we're going to go back for just a minute to our guest from earlier in the show, Dan Murphy, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. When we last talked about the story last hour, we had mentioned that air raid sirens had gone off in Jerusalem, and that was a very new development in the Israel-Gaza problem that's been going on all week. And now we know more about what actually happened in Israel's capital. Dan, there was an actual missile, wasn't there?
There seems to have been. There were fairly credible reports from the Israeli side of one, maybe two strikes near Jerusalem. They have not been very clear where. They don't want to be, because if they give out information with precision and somebody on the other end of the line has a mortar tube, they can dial in and become more accurate. But it sure does seem like something that blew up was lobbed in the direction of Jerusalem.
So something blew up. We don't know for sure that it was a missile, to be very clear about that, but it seems credible that maybe to probably it was. And then Hamas is claiming that their rocket, that it was one of their rockets, and that it was aimed at the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Do you find that credible?
I find that it's credible that if they fired one of these homemade rockets in the general direction of Jerusalem, they would love for it to hit the Knesset. However, those things are directional. They have terrible precision. They can't, if they fire something, at a particular spot, it could hit a couple miles either side of it. And they really wouldn't know when it left. And that's what's so interesting about it to me. That thing could have landed on a Palestinian village over there. It could have landed on the Temple Mount, where Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock, and the Western Wall are. It's a very odd escalation, both as a choice from Hamas, and then it's also a very dangerous escalation because this is going to certainly spread both the fear and the anger on the better-armed Israeli side of this.
That's an interesting point about the lack of precision of those rockets, and with a large Palestinian population in and around Jerusalem, the vulnerability of them of potentially getting hit. But also on the political side, unless the Palestinians, Hamas in particular, is trying to draw Israel into a major ground assault, which Israel is deliberating whether to mount, unless they're trying to draw them in, why would they start attacking Jerusalem of all places?
Maybe they are, although that seems crazy when we say it. It could just be anger, wanting to strike out, wanting to strike back. Maybe we hope we'll hit the Knesset. There's also, if you want, not conspiratorially, but you begin to wonder if Hamas is hoping to create a much bigger conflict to inflame Arab and regional public opinion. And then maybe that puts pressure on Egypt to become a particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, to put their sort of best foot forward in supporting Hamas, to really get in their camp. I remember that the Emir of Qatar, went to Gaza, what was it, a month and a half ago, mm-hmm. And a lot of kind of the rich Gulf monarchies have been looking at Hamas more lately than the Fatah of Mahmoud Abbas, in the West Bank, from whom, by the way, we've heard almost nothing in the past couple of days. So that's one possible semi-rational explanation. But I guess my first instinct is to assume that they're just angry and they're lashing out because of their feeling of siege. We'll see in the next couple hours, in the next couple of days.
Or it didn't happen, which still seems to be a remote possibility. Just real quick, does Twitter help or hurt the flow of information right now? Because Twitter is kind of taking over in terms of where a lot of people are getting their information about this fast-changing situation. And I'm sure it's being used as a propaganda tool, not just an information tool, by many involved.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the answer to the question is it's both. If you're a reasonably sophisticated media consumer and then you have a well-curated list of people that you know and trust who are verified accounts, they happen to be in Jerusalem. A friend of mine, Lauren Bond, is there. And when she said the Arab silence went off, on Twitter, I knew that Lauren was saying that and that it was really happening. Other stuff that inflaming sorts of things that come out from accounts that you've never heard of, claims of massacres. There was a claim that an F-16 was shot down over Khan Yunis. Some people believe for a minute. There's no evidence that it was. I very much doubt it. That can travel around the world in an instant. It's like old newspapers. It's trusting the newspaper. It's trusting the Twitter source. There's just so much more of a cacophony online that you have to have even more care than we did in the old days.
Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Dan Murphy, thanks for jumping back on with us for a few minutes to update the situation. And folks, I want to just tell you that Dan's own Twitter feed is a very good source of information, and that's Bung Dan, at BUNGDAN. Dan, thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.